I'm not somebody who sits down and goes, I'm going to write a play about this specific subject or write about that thing. I kind of, because I think all the best plays are about lots of things, actually, and they're essentially a story. And so the way I write tends to just have a sort of dramatic dynamic, and then something grows out of that. And and then I sort of, in order to find out what it's about, because you sort of sometimes need to have a sense of that in order to know where to cut it and refine it and shape it. But I then just read back into the play, like anyone would, and go, well, oh, it seems to be about this, and therefore that's where the focus should be. But I think it's really interesting for me, anyway, that, yes, there is that in Earthquakes. There is the sense of a younger generation, younger characters, suddenly waking up to realise that they haven't got the things that they were told they were going to have, or they the future is not nearly as secure as it maybe seemed to be. But it's interesting for me that Earthquakes is a sort of, obviously, quite a big play and quite London-centred and quite sort of epic in a sense, and dealing with that question in terms of big global issues about what are we going to do in the future. And then there's another play which Payne's Power doing at the end of the year called Love, 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 which is about, actually, I've only just made this connection, but is actually also is far more explicitly about generational conflict and the baby boomer generation versus our generation. And I suppose it's like often, I think this happens with plays, you find a question in one play, try and answer it in the next one. And I think I found in Earthquakes that there was a whole, that the focus of Earthquakes was very much about, you know, a sort of global sense and a city-wide sense of what might be going wrong and what's going to happen and all of that. But there was something very interesting that I didn't have time to explore in the play about smaller things about our generation versus the older one. So university fees and pensions and the ageing population and property and things like I just noticed suddenly that everyone says that when their grandparents were 30, they lived in a flat. When their parents were 30, they lived in a house. And now we're 30 and we live in a flat again. And just that sort of shape of things is touched on in Earthquakes, but is more sort of explicit subject of love.
I mean, I don't know whether you think you... I suppose maybe you can't speak for your generation of writers, but it does feel as though there's something in the water now that's distinctly different to the... I suppose the mid-90s surge of new writing. And I suppose it's partly that sense of greater malaise. And I suppose this has been a decade of quite profound possibility for pessimism, I suppose. It feels as though things have been going wrong in quite a serial way. Mm. But I mean, have you felt that there was a kind of watershed moment or even a process where you had grown up with a certain rosy view of the future, which was then disrupted?
Well, I think absolutely there has been around, certainly I've noticed it around, you know, from sort of 27, nearly 30. But what I don't know, maybe you can answer that, is whether every generation, as they get to the age where they're about to have children, recontextualise their own childhood and their own upbringing. Mm-hmm. And as they go, well, what am I going to do if I have a family? When they start to think about that, they think, well, what happened to me? And what have I been given? And what do I want to get? You know, and that sense of passing on, and am I going to be a better father than my father, and was he a better father than his father, and all that sort of thing, I suspect happens with every generation. I think that there's just something, I don't know whether it's a sort of postmodern thought, but that it feels like to me that we've grown up with the past on our shoulders, in terms of we were always told, I remember growing up in the 80s being told the 60s were incredible. If you'd been here 20 years ago, you would have had an amazing time. And at the same time, our grandparents going, well, actually, you know, England was a sort of better country, actually, when we were young as well, even though we had the war.
Yeah.
We, you know, at least we had standards, you know. And I think that we've grown up, every music that our generation make would be compared to a band in the 60s and told they're not as good, or they're drawing on that. And you don't, and in a way that I don't know if that was always the case. And I think that what I think is exciting, and I hope is happening, is that there is a kind of throwing off of some of that at the moment, and going, we've had enough. We actually just want to do things without a kind of constant contextualisation in the past, and a constant sense of of you're doing what we did, but you're doing it slightly worse, or you're doing, you know, it's a homage to this. The idea of doing something unironically, I think, is certainly attractive to me. I hope it's sort of understandably cynical about business, language, politics, everything.
Yeah.
Because I think it's an entirely understandable response to the fact that you're constantly being you're constantly being sold something, and you're constantly being treated like you can't think for yourself. Because actually, you know, if you, it's sort of easier to be stupid, and I suppose that. But I think what's really important is that, for me, that, you know, you could have a thing where it's my generation moaning against the previous one. It's everything's rubbish. It's terrible, and it's awful. But I hope there's also something in the play to say, actually, to sort of show the world as being brilliant as well, as being sort of how lucky we are, and how much opportunity there is to do the things you want to do, and to think, and to progress exactly in that sense, whether that's progress sort of personally or progress politically. I hope that there is there's always a way forward, and that way forward comes out of trying to think of solutions that if our generation, it's not good enough to sit around moaning about our parents. It's not good enough to sit around just saying, well, we didn't have the things that, and we had to pay for it. We've actually got to try and fight now and do something. You know, you've got your adult years to do your work. I did experience the earthquake in London in 2008, the very small earthquake that didn't do very much. But I was, you know, it woke me up, and my room was shaking, and it had that, the walls were slightly just shifting.
Yeah.
And I think that idea of, that theatrical idea of an alienation effect, that you something that you take for granted, suddenly when you walk out of the theatre seems incredibly strange. Well, the earthquake sort of did that with my house. So suddenly the walls were not fixed, even the ground could be shifting, literally. And then once you get into that territory, you've got, you know, the earth moved, ground shifting beneath our feet. You've got it's a brilliant sort of, it's full of metaphor and meaning, I think, as soon as you start talking about that, and phrases that we use all the time, like it's not the end of the world. And for me, that's like a far more sort of interesting way of getting into subjects like climate change. But then on the other side, there were some, I thought, what, when does it feel like the end of the world? And for me, moments when it felt like the end of the world was when I was in a queue for the bank, and there was an old lady who wanted to sit down but wanted to keep her place in the queue, and she was asking them if she could sit down, and they said, you can sit down there. She said, but I need my place in the queue. And they went, well, and no one would help her. And then she was getting more and more distressed, and other people in the queue were laughing at her. And it sounds like that small moment to me, I left that bank feeling like it's the end. Forget it. There's no hope. If a business who has a customer can't find a way of allowing her to do what she came into the shop to do, and if other people are not helping her but are just laughing at her, then to me that's the moment when I feel like, well, just forget it. I mean, there is absolutely no hope. You know, to me that's as depressing as anything. And I think the plays are sort of, they're putting those two things together in a way. Theatre is a very closed, quite artistically literate sort of group of people who know a lot about the latest bands and think of themselves as being quite fashionable. And so when I would think about Coldplay, you know, people get married to that music. They love that music. They live their lives by it. They listen to it on the way to work and believe and emote through it. And that sort of popular music, but you mention it to people who are sort of in the art world, and they'll be incredibly snobby and sniffy about it. And I really wanted to put some of that music in a play where it wasn't done ironically. We weren't laughing at Coldplay. We're actually genuinely saying that for most people, pop music has that purpose in their lives, that they imagine that they're in an American miniseries, and this is the montage section at the end, and or there's some brilliant, you know, you've Yahoo questions and stuff, and there's some brilliant questions that I came across when I was looking for music, which is like, give me the top 10 songs to pick myself up when I feel rubbish. And then you've got these, all these 10 play, you know, these playlists of like Bon Jovi or AC/DC, and you sort of go, this, there's a value in these songs are the soundtrack to our lives, that some songs you are cool, but I think the songs in the play relate to the characters, and the one other songs that they would listen to, and it's a fine line. As soon as I got looked at climate change science, what was fascinating was how biased it was one way or the other. It's really difficult to find any kind of authority on it, which is quite sort of unique. Most subjects there is an authority on, sort of you know, there is a general consensus that it's happening, absolutely, but within that there's all different sorts of you know, responses and you know, and predictions ranging from it'll all be over in 100 years, we're entirely doomed, to nothing is happening whatsoever and we're absolutely fine and we should stop worrying about it. Yeah. Which is brilliant as a stage, to try and stage all those different viewpoints. But I don't think it's a play. I really don't want it to be a play which goes, you know, you must recycle everyone, and it is a very important subject. I think people are so much cleverer than that. I think they don't want to be lectured. They read a lot of articles, they read a lot of books, they see a lot of documentaries on this stuff, that they don't come to theatre for more of that. They come for a story and to think in a more sort of to think and feel in a sort of more visceral, tangible, human way. There's a lot of brilliant theatre going on at the moment, and I think it's just that the most important thing about theatre and what it does brilliantly, and why it's the thing that I've been totally fascinated by for the last, you know, 10 years, is that it can totally respond and reflect and change the world right now, tonight. And so I think John Osborne was writing against authority and feeling constrained by those or by the figures, the you know, the few figures in the world telling him how to live. I think that we might feel constrained more by things like the sheer amount of information, the sheer number of companies, the sheer fact that you can't walk around any space without being sold something and seeing adverts. I think that to me feels just as restrictive, but in a very different way. And so in terms of what theatre you need to make, you know, John Osborne might write A Man in a Box shouting against the world, because he's got everything, he's doing what he's been told to do, but he's stuck. But if I'm trying to write a play where people have the internet on their phone about all this music, they have everything, they have iPads and iPods, and they're thinking 12 things and they're working on all the, you know, then the form of theatre has to reflect that, and I think you should try and keep up. You know, I think that the worst thing is when the world that people experience before they go into the theatre is more interesting than the world that happens in the theatre. And the best theatre for me is when you go into the theatre seeing the world one way, and you come out and you see the same world, but you see it in an entirely different way. I think a lot of people, and I think a lot of people are sort of asking, saying, why aren't young writers writing big plays with proper long scenes and 12 characters all in the same room, all having dinner, whatever, like they used to? And I think it's for the simple reason that 30 years ago, you used to have 12 people in a room sitting down having dinner for a long time. Now, their phones will be going off, they'll be coming in and out, they'll have to, you know, that most conversations you have are with under 5 people, and they're for a less than an hour. And I think that simply the plays reflect that changing experience.